Good evening.
Hello. Hi.
It's a pleasure to be here with you all. It's a great pleasure. Tonight I'd like to talk to you about a discourse. This is the Samyutta Nikaya, the collected discourses of the Buddha. And in this collection, this is one of five Nikayas of the Pali Canon, and they're all about this big, so it's a huge, voluminous collection of literature. And in this one, there is a sutta called the Upanisāda Sutta, which is the sutta on proximate conditions. And you may have heard of dependent origination. That's in a lot of places in the Pali Canon. But this sutta is about liberative dependent origination. So the ordinary dependent origination, as you may know, begins with ignorance, and then there are 12 links that end up with suffering or dukkha. Whereas this sutta actually begins with dukkha, with suffering or unsatisfactoriness. And there are 12 conditions leading to complete awakening and finally the knowledge of awakening. So I'd kind of like to start this talk a bit about talking about the end point of the practice, which is Nibbana, which is the soteriological religious goal of Buddhist practitioners. It's pretty hard to convey what it is because it's the unconditioned. You probably know that the Pali text, it's a language that's very close to Sanskrit. In Sanskrit, Nibbana is Nirvana. And in many ways, it's the opposite of samsara. Samsara is it literally means in Pali, wandering. So we're wandering through this life and chained to this wheel that is keeping us suffering. And so our practice consists of getting off the wheel of samsara and onto the path that is going to take us to liberation. It's also interesting that in the early text, the word Nibbana is kind of used metaphorically. In Pali, it literally means blowing out, like blowing out a candle or an oil lamp. So extinguishing the fuel that keeps us hooked on samsara. When one attains Nibbana, one has extinguished the fire of greed, hate, and delusion. And so when a candle is blown out in Pali, it is Nibbanized. So Nibbana is not a place, it's not like a heaven, although sometimes it's called a destination. It's more of a process of something that happens. So I'd like to begin by reading you a text. This is from the Samyutta number 43, in which the Buddha addresses his disciples as bhikkhus. And bhikkhu in Pali literally means monk. The Buddha uses it also to refer to all of his disciples. So it includes the monks and the nuns and the laity. So we can consider that we're all bhikkhus here. He's talking to us when he says bhikkhus. So let me read you the first sutta in this this collection of suttas on the unconditioned. And the very first one, and often in these texts, the most important ones are put first. They're kind of that special position. It kind of gives emphasis and sets the tone for everything that comes after. And this very first sutta on the unconditioned is entitled Mindfulness Directed to the Body. That's just what we were doing earlier. So the Buddha is at Savatthi. The Buddha says, Bhikkhus, I will teach you the unconditioned and the path leading to the unconditioned. Listen to that. And what, bhikkhus, is the unconditioned? The destruction of greed, the destruction of hate, the destruction of delusion. This is called the unconditioned. And what, bhikkhus, is the path leading to the unconditioned? Mindfulness directed to the body. This is called the path leading to the unconditioned. Thus, bhikkhus, I have taught you the unconditioned and the path leading to the unconditioned. Whatever should be done, bhikkhus, by a compassionate teacher, out of compassion for his disciples, desiring their welfare, that I have done for you. These are the feet of trees, bhikkhus. These are empty huts. Meditate, bhikkhus. Do not be negligent, lest you regret it later. This is our instruction to you. So, there you go. That's what we're supposed to do. But you just think about that for a minute. That the path to the unconditioned or nirvana is mindfulness of the body.
Sounds so simple.
It sounds so simple. And in fact, it is so simple, except that it's so difficult to really be able to stay there. And then he goes on in this same samyutta. Samyutta means a collection. This exact same text is repeated many times with other things. The next one is serenity and insight. So instead of saying mindfulness of the body, he says serenity and insight. So there are other things that we cultivate as well. But mindfulness of the body is the first. So with your permission, I'd like to do a tiny guided meditation with you right now. To sort of give you a taste of what Nibbana might be. And it comes from this same Samyutta. And it's all the ways the Buddha himself, all the synonyms that he uses to refer to Nibbana, or the unconditioned. So close your eyes, and I'll read these synonyms that the Buddha uses when he's referring to Nibbana. The unconditioned, the taintless, the truth, the far shore, the subtle, very difficult to see, the unaging, the stable, the undisintegrating, the unmanifest, the unproliferated, the peaceful, the deathless, the sublime, the auspicious, the secure, the destruction of craving, the wonderful, the amazing, the unailing, the unafflicted, dispassion, purity, freedom, the unadhesive, the island, the shelter, the asylum, the refuge, the destination. So this, as Buddhist practitioners, is where we're all headed. So in this Upanishad Sutta, where he describes the conditions that give rise to liberation, I'm going to go through those and talk about them with you. The first condition is dukkha, meeting our suffering with wisdom. So that's pretty interesting that, you know, that our path to freedom actually begins with our suffering. And I think it's something like if we weren't suffering, we wouldn't be motivated to even try to become free. There are also in the early texts a lot of references to the devas. These are the gods. They live in heavens and they have fabulous lifestyles and they're just always happy and ethereal and they never have pain and they have delicious food and they live long lives. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful scene. But it's conditioned. It's, you know, eventually it's not going to last and they'll be born somewhere else. But it's not a place where it's easy to become enlightened because they don't have any dukkha. So the ideal is a human form. You may have heard the metaphor of, you know, how to kind of give an idea of how rare it is to encounter the teachings of the Buddha and how even more rare it is to have the occasion to practice. And somewhere in the suttas, I don't remember where, there's the image of the vast oceans, and someone throws a wooden plank into the sea that has a hole in the middle. And this thing is floating out there for years, going along with the currents. And it was the way that they were trying to calculate probability in those days. They said that the chances of encountering the Buddha's teaching are the chances that a sea turtle would, when surfacing, his head would go through the hole in that piece of wood somewhere. So we're pretty lucky to be here and to have encountered the Buddha's teachings. The next thing I'll read to you is two very short suttas in here. The first one is called Mind, and the second one is called Craving. And this is from the first collection in this volume, which is a collection of verses. So the Sutta on Mind says, "By what is the world led around? By what is it dragged here and there? What is the one thing that has all under its control? The world is led around by mind. By mind it's dragged here and there. Mind is the one thing that has all under its control." So this gives you kind of an idea of why we are trying to purify the mind in our meditation. And the next one is entitled Craving, and it's going to sound very familiar to you now that you've heard mind. It says, by what is the world led around? By what is it dragged here and there? What is the one thing that has all under its control? The world is led around by craving. By craving, it is dragged here and there. Craving is the one thing that has all under its control. So they obviously weren't trying to be consistent by saying, you know, it's all, and it goes on, there's more things afterwards that, you know, where it's all under the control of those two. But those are the two of the things that weigh us down. And so this is, you know, the mind and our cravings are the problem, and they're also the solution. So you may have heard of the eight worldly winds. They pretty much sum up the things that lead us this way and that. We're buffeted by these eight worldly winds, and even disciples of the Buddha, you know, experience the eight worldly winds. They're gain and loss, pleasure and pain, praise and blame, and fame and disrepute. So the danger of gain and pleasure and praise and fame are that we like those things and we're attracted to them and we kind of start to crave them and latch onto them, and our sense of self is kind of gratified and consolidated, and eventually that's all going to pass away. And it's not something that we can count on for a lifetime of freedom. And then on the other side, the loss, the pain, being blamed, being held in disrepute, you know, that can be exceedingly painful. I did my master's thesis on the Terigata, which is the poems of awakening of the Buddha's first female disciples, and quite a number of those enlightened women were absolutely destroyed by the grief of having lost a child or more than one child, and some to the point of insanity. So loss is it's really something that is part of our human condition. And it's something that we need to eventually make friends with, that, you know, loss is going to happen. Pain happens. Go ahead.
Which brings something up that I didn't want to pass over, at least in my mind. Are we not judging these things in such a way that we're making it more than what it is, or we're turning it into a negative? Like you mentioned it as some these things, greed, hate, as fire. And so are we not judging it too harshly and making it more than what it is? Even the pain. If we must endure pain, why is it such a bad thing? And when we do judge it that way, it becomes more than what it is.
That's true. That's very true. The best way to live with pain is to turn towards it and, if possible, let go of it. But it's true that if we have aversion to the pain, it's only going to get worse. It's only going to hurt more. So there's wisdom in what you say. But the Buddha was very clear that the path towards freedom does require that we eliminate greed, hate, and delusion.
Because it's bad.
Yeah, it causes harm.
And what if we didn't look at it as something that was bad?
I think that would qualify as delusion.
Well, excuse me for interfering.
It's okay. No, I'm glad you did. I have another sutta here I might read to you, but I'm looking at the time and maybe I'll refrain from that. Now, it's a beautiful sutta called Nakula Pita, about this old man who's dying and comes to the Buddha for advice. But the truth of the door to freedom opening with dukkha, I think is an amazing concept. And what this means for me in practice is that whenever I'm confronted with something that hurts or something that's unsatisfactory, I try to remember that I'm at a fork in the road. Let's say somebody expresses some really nasty anger towards me. If I reply with reactivity and giving anger back, I'm only going to increase the suffering, both for the other person and for myself, and maybe for other people too. So we're at a fork in the road when we're in the presence of dukkha, when we're experiencing dukkha. And we can either go down the road towards more suffering with our reactivity, or if we have sufficient mindfulness to see what's happening, to say, oh, wow, this person's really angry. Maybe they're having a really hard time, and maybe I can have some compassion for them. And maybe I don't have to take it personally. So the concept of not self has helped me a lot in dealing with situations like this. This is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. I recognize that the anger is coming from them and that I didn't have that much to do with creating it. And so with that, I can let it roll off my back. And a choice like that is a choice towards going down the path to freedom, where I can respond to the person instead of being nasty back, I can be compassionate back. And then that's a good thing for both of us. So that's just one example, but I think it's useful to remember that whenever we're in the face of some kind of suffering, that we have a choice. And one choice is maybe our conditioning and our reactivity. And we may miss the choice if we don't have the mindfulness to pause a little bit. And the other choice is finding some skillful way to deal with the situation and take one small step in the direction of freedom. So that's the first condition, is that we experience dukkha and we begin meeting our dukkha with some modicum of wisdom. And so all these conditions give rise to the next condition. It's like you plant a seed, and if there's, you know, soil and rain and sunshine, there's going to be a plant that comes up. So what comes up naturally from the condition of meeting suffering with wisdom is faith. Or confidence, and that's sadha in Pali. So how does that work? I think it comes from our own personal experience, just like as I was saying in the meditation, that we really end up having to become our own teachers. When we start making wiser responses to situations of suffering, we see, oh yeah, that's, you know, that's a lot better than being reactive. And we start to have some confidence that this is something I'd like to do. I'd like to develop that more. I'd like to do more of this going down the path towards freedom. And so the confidence comes from our own experience. It's not like, you know, faith arises in some deity elsewhere. That's not it at all. It's that we start to see that this path that we're on is a good path. It's something that we want to be on. And the more confidence we have, that gives rise to the next condition, which is gladness. We're glad to be on this path. We see that this is a healthy thing, that we're actually somewhat happier than we were 10 years ago or 6 months ago. We're glad. So suffering giving rise to confidence, and then this confidence in that this is a path that we want to walk, and we're glad about it. And gladness is a lovely mind state that in turn gives rise to joy. And joy in this meaning of joy in Pali is PT, and PT is a characteristic of the jhana states, the early jhanas. And the jhanas are these states of deep absorption in meditation. So the first and second jhanas are characterized by joy and other things as well. And it's you don't have to do anything for it to happen except to get really concentrated, and boom, this joy just like lights up. Sometimes it's kind of quiet, but sometimes it's really, really, really intense. And it's exhilarating, and it's inspiring, and it's uplifting. It's also, this PT is also one of the seven factors of awakening. And it has a role in that process as well. So that's a really positive mind state that I think reinforces our desire to be on the path, because it's really juicy. But because it's so juicy, at some point, if you want your meditation to go deeper, you have to let go of it. And when you let go of the joy, that naturally gives rise to tranquility. And tranquility is also one of the seven factors of awakening. And that's when we have a moment of peace, of inner peace. And it's this is a very important condition for all the other conditions that follow, that, you know, that that thinking mind, it's not doing that anymore, and we're not even interested in it doing that anymore. Because what we've experienced already with the joy is so much more beautiful than any of the, you know, the to-do lists or the fantasies or the recriminations that we could invent. You know, it's a much more satisfying state of mind. And so tranquility is a wonderful thing. You know, it's, when we have peace inside, then we're in a good place to give peace to others and to help make this world a more peaceful place. I should say that these conditions that do give rise one to the other in a sort of linear fashion, that's true, but in practice, actually, when you're practicing with these conditions, They'll arise at different times. They'll be strong at different times and weaker at other times. And you'll be revisiting them. And maybe there's like a spiral. It's not a straight line in practice. And tranquility, you know, some of you may have experienced a moment of tranquility this evening. Then tranquility gives rise to sukha. Do you know what sukha is? Yeah, it's the opposite of dukkha. And it's a beautiful state of peaceful happiness. It's unlike PT, which is so exhilarating. Sukha is like just being so peaceful and having such a sense of well-being that is we're just deeply content with everything. And that's the key factor that is the condition for samadhi to arise. Samadhi being deep concentration. So, if we want to have concentration in our meditation, we have to get happy and tranquil and joyful and glad and confident. And actually, the course that I'll be offering, you know, for the next 7.5 months, we'll be developing those mind states. So samadhi is usually translated into English as concentration, but that can be a bit unfortunate because it does involve concentration. But concentration, there's another kind of concentration in Pali, which is called ekagata, which means one-pointedness. So there is this one-pointedness, and that can be very useful for getting to samadhi. But samadhi is much more than that. It's, I think it's better translated into English as unification. It's where we're so collected and so maybe concentrated in an open way. It's not the kind of concentration that is excluding things, but it's a kind of concentration that has an open awareness component to it. And we're unified with our experience. It's not like, you know, I'm here and something else is happening over there. The subject-object issue is not active. The sense of self is not active. And it's a very beautiful mind state. The first six of these conditions, from meeting suffering with wisdom up through happiness, are all things that we can work on in some way. Although, you know, we do have to, as our practice goes on, become less of a doer and more of a receiver, because that doing sometimes energizes a sense of self, and then that, of course, creates problems. So in this path that I'm describing, the first six are conditions that we can try to cultivate. But samadhi, we can't make it happen. It happens when it's time. It happens when those conditions are ripe. But if we try to say, okay, in this meditation period, I'm gonna do it. I'm samadhi or bust. You know, it's not gonna happen. you know, samadhi is kind of waiting for you to get out of the way. but you can start getting out of the way by putting in place these six other beautiful conditions. I think of it as a state of grace. And I also think of samadhi as the critical point in this series of 12 conditions that end with liberation. Because chances of going into samadhi when you've just come back from the grocery store are small. It's a lot easier if you're on a long retreat and you've had several days to let the mind quiet down and get settled, or maybe several weeks or more. The practice of samadhi is, I think, the linchpin or something in this series, because it's samadhi that allows us to have insight, vipassana. So a lot of times we say that, we practice vipassana, and that's all very well and good, but actually we don't. We practice mindfulness, and vipassana is hopefully what we get to through all this practice. The Pali word in this sutta for insight is not vipassana, it's yata bhuta jnana dasana, which means literally knowledge and vision of things as they are. In samadhi, the mind becomes sufficiently clear, sufficiently empty, sufficiently receptive, that we can finally actually see things the way they are. It's like in the meditation I was talking about, observing the beginning, the middle, and the end of a breath. But even at an even finer scale, in samadhi, you may be observing the pixelated quality of little instants of momentary experience, and you see things arise and pass away, and arise and pass away. And it's seeing this arising and passing away that is the key to insight. And knowledge and vision of things as they are, what that means is knowledge of the three characteristics of existence. Many of you know what these are, but for those of you who don't, the first one is dukkha. You've heard of that before. So what that means as a characteristic of existence is that everything in our existence has some quality of either pain or suffering or unsatisfactoriness, even if it's a wonderful experience. Let's say we just had a fabulous cake and we're just, it just couldn't be more delicious. But that's not going to last. And so the dukkha of that experience is the fact that it's going to be gone. And, and in fact, everything in life is going to be that way. Everything, when we die, we lose everything. We lose everything that we love. We lose every person that we love. We are separated from all the pleasures of the world. And so that's the first characteristic of existence, is that clinging to anything in this world is going to bring unhappiness, that we have to be able to let go of it all. And the second characteristic of existence is impermanence. So that's very linked to the dukkha part. It's the impermanence of everything that that we need to really see. And for most people, it's that becomes the light bulb for liberation. And the third characteristic of existence is probably the most challenging one for us. It's the characteristic of not-self. That in this world, if we really try to pinpoint, you know, who Ian is, who, you know, who Kathy is, or who Jerry is, it's kind of hard to do. It looks like they're here, you know. But, you know, if we took a picture of you when you were 4 years old and a picture of you now, you know, there's a big difference. And in fact, there's not a single molecule in your body when you were four that's in your body today. So, you know, literally, you're physically not the same person that you were before. And then the mind has also changed, and all the things that have happened to us have made other conditions. And you try putting your finger on exactly, you know, who's Meg. There's nothing there. We're all in a flow. It's just too liquid who we are. You know, there's nothing that we can actually hang on to and say, yeah, this is me. Those are the three things that we see when we have the insight that samadhi opens up for us. And from the point of samadhi on, the rest down the rest of these conditions, like samadhi, we can't make them happen. They're like dominoes. You know, that once we have samadhi, eventually we're going to have insight. It's going to come. Once we have insight, it's going to lead straight to disenchantment. We don't know when, but, you know, it's going to happen. So what insight gives rise to, once we see the truth of impermanence, of dukkha, and of not-self, and we don't just see it intellectually, but we know it from our real lived experience in the state of samadhi, we have this insight that gives rise to disenchantment. And disenchantment means that we fall out of love with all of our delusions that we've had in the past. It's sort of like a magician. You know, if you see a magician do a magic trick, that magician can do the trick over and over again, and it's always, you know, really gotcha. You know, it's just amazing. Until you figure out how they've done it. And once you've seen through how the trick is done, you're not enchanted by it anymore. You know, it's like, okay, yeah, that was good. But you're not in the spell of the magic trick anymore. And so this disenchantment actually has a very positive sense in this path. Meaning that our insight allows us to let go of, fall out of love with what we were clinging to before. And disenchantment then automatically leads to dispassion. And dispassion is where our clinging really starts to subside. We really just, we're just not interested anymore in all that stuff that we used to cling to, especially me, myself, and mine, you know. It just fades away. And in Pali, the word viraga, it literally means fading away. Raga means like a dye. And so it's like a piece of cloth that's so used that the dye fades. And with dispassion, that gives rise to liberation. And that all happens organically and naturally once we have this, the insight. And you'd think that might be the end of the path, but no. The last step after liberation is the knowledge of liberation. So it's not enough just to become free, but it's really important to actually know that we're free. And this was very clear in the poems I was studying for my thesis, these poems of awakening in which the nuns were describing their experiences of awakening. And in each one of them, it was an actual literary expression of this knowledge of awakening. So the knowledge of awakening is important because it would allow the practitioner to teach awakening. So that's the one step beyond. So I think we can stop there and have questions if you'd like. Yes. I haven't turned it on.
So thank you very much. I know I haven't reached the final step of your path there, all the steps.
I'm not speaking from experience either.
Many of the things you described, I resonate with me, and so I wonder, do you think it's possible at various stages to, you know, have glimpses into those?
Absolutely, yes. That's what I was saying before about how sometimes, you know, there's a spiral or some of these things come up, and it does work that way. And in a way, I think what in studying these conditions that lead to liberation, we revisit them again and again and again, and we deepen them, you know, and maybe we have some experience of joy that then, you know, and then sometimes quite a bit later we have some experience of tranquility, and then way after that we might have the confidence that's informed by that tranquility, you know, that I think they do work together that way in ways that are kind of organic and that come up with what we're experiencing in our practice. So yeah, we visit them, and the more we do, the more accessible they become and the deeper they become. And that's what I said at the end of the meditation, to when you have a taste of one of these, to savor it. Because that helps it to register in us and helps us to be open to it and receptive to it more easily the next time it comes around. So if you do experience some of these mind states, don't let your doubt come up and try to take you away. Don't let Mara come and say, don't pay any attention to that. Say, Mara, I see you. And then, like, give yourself a moment of, wow, that was nice.
So, samsara. My name is Raphael.
Raphael?
Okay. Yeah, samsara, the cycle of suffering. I've pretty much had a war with it, where I either try to extinguish it, try to run away from it, try to fight it, overcome it, and none of those worked. It just led to more suffering, more pain. And so I'm thinking, though, what if I had visualized this samsara, this pain, this suffering, as a beautiful flower? and embrace it. Touch it, feel it, not try to run away from it, not try to struggle and fight with it.
Have you tried that?
What would have been the difference?
Have you tried it?
I'm trying it now.
I think it's a very valid way of approaching difficult situations. You know, as I said earlier, we're all really our own teachers, and a lot of what we do in this practice is we experiment. So try that out. That might be just what it takes in the situation that you're dealing with. When the Buddha talks about anger at one point, and he gives all these different ways to deal with anger or very, very negative mind states. And they go from the more subtle to the less subtle, you know, like first you just ignore it, and if that doesn't work, then you think of something else, change your mind, and if that doesn't work, then you just I forget what the last one was, but. You know,
one of them for me was to displace it, pass it off.
And that can be skillful also. So you experiment with different ways of responding to your suffering, and you take note of what works for you, and different things will work in different conditions. It's not always the same solution. So you'll find your way. But I think what you're talking about is certainly a valid approach. You have to, when you're doing something like that, you have to watch out for not repressing what's going on. You know, because we all know that repression is not ultimately a healthy thing. But if you can do it with wisdom, it's worth a try.
Regarding Vipassana, isn't Vipassana something that unfolds all along rather than being more of an apotheosis at the toward the end?
Like, yes.
Oh, it sounded like you were saying Vipassana only happens at stage 7 or something like that.
No. So, you know, there's little insight and medium insight and big insight and ultimate insight, you know, and they're all good. And so just like all these other qualities, yes, absolutely, Vipassana, having little insights is very important in the practice, because this is how we learn and how we see what the right path is. So that's a great question.
I was just wondering, because you said it wasn't Vipassana meditation, really.
No, I was sort of saying that tongue-in-cheek, but what I mean is Vipassana is not a tool. Mindfulness is and concentration are the tools.
Okay, thanks.
So, you know, we practice mindfulness and concentration, and then we get a little, we get tastes of insight.
So Vipassana is the result of
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
I am interested in Raphael's point of view that he brought up. Point of view. Right view, maybe. I think what he challenged in my mind was having, what is my view of suffering? And he asked, could it be a beautiful flower? Could that be my view of suffering? And I've read recently, what resonates with me is that in that discomfort, in that unsatisfactoriness, that moves us towards the path of the practice that the gods don't have that motivation for. that's the flower, in that it is giving us the motivation for the path. And as it puts it on the path, that view of the discomfort and unsatisfaction is pointing you towards, pointing you, directing you towards work, or directing you towards a place where attitude shift needs to happen, or directing you towards delusion of your experience. And that piece of information is pure gold. It is a flower.
Thank you, Gorky. That's beautifully said.
Welcome.
A lovely contribution. Thank you. Is somebody behind you?
I don't mean this at all in a facetious way, but it is something I've always wondered. When we talk about that point at which you see things as they really are, how do you know that that's not another delusion?
Because by that time, you do know. Samadhi is a state where the mind is so pure and so it's empty of delusions at that point. All the clinging and the delusions of the, you know, that are created by our thinking mind, it's fallen away. So it's this radiant emptiness that is ready to see things as they are. Earlier in the practice, you know the five hindrances. One of the hindrances, and perhaps the most dangerous one, is the hindrance of doubt. And so, working with that hindrance, we learn to be more attuned to see what's true for us, what's not true for us, and what's delusion and what's not delusion. But the practice will, you know, the Dharma takes us where we need to go. If you stay with your practice, you know, stay with your meditation, it will become clear.
One more moment, a moment. One of the biggest difficulties that I have in my practice is with the word enough. It's another sort of value word. So are hard and difficult feelings that I am trying to process, are they negative? Are they suffering? And is that negative? And should I try and run away from them, avoid them, not have them? How do I turn to them and hold them if I, like Raphael suggests, say that they're not negative? They are just on the other end of the spectrum of beautiful feelings, and that there's a full spectrum of feelings, and that true happiness and joy is being comforted with the full spectrum of experience. Then I have to stop dividing it dualistically into good and bad and beautiful and ugly. I have to embrace the totality of it. And sometimes naming it its opposite, as he suggested, naming it beautiful when it's ugly, puts me into a momentary paradox where I really try and ask myself, could it be a beautiful feeling? What about it is a beautiful feeling? And I feel like I get closer to the truth when I'm trying to resolve that paradox. And that's why right view seems so powerful to me. And it brings me back to the words moment and enough. You said, I believe, that you will have moments of achieving each one of these 12 stages, and it won't be lineal. They will come, they will go, you will be visited by these moments. Are moments enough? I think this is a huge cultural problem for me and for many people. What is enough? Should I be satisfied with life that is just full of a few moments of this or that? Certainly that can't be enough. But to change my view and say that those are moments of miracle and awe makes me embrace those moments, and one moment then leads to another moment, and they become the fuel for the practice.
Well, I think in this practice, reflection is a big part of our practice as Buddhists, reflecting on you know, what we do. But at the same time, it's not a terribly intellectual practice in it when we're actually doing it. So with, say, very difficult emotions, usually the first thing to do is to pause and really be present with those difficult emotions. Don't worry about saying whether they're negative or they're positive or whether they're enough or not enough. All you have to do is just really be there with it and experience the physicality of where it's located in your body, what's going on in your mind. That's enough. My root teacher, the Zen master Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, he used to say, it's enough. Just to be alive is enough. And I think gratitude also has a nice role in our practice, that, you know, we may be dying and there may be lots of things we wish we could do before we die and it's not going to happen, and yet we could also have so much gratitude for the life we've lived, and that could be enough. Even then. So this practice has a lot to do with finding our peace in what the present moment is delivering us moment after moment, you know. And that's why, you know, I asked you, what would it be like if really being connected with your breathing could be a teacher? And that's just one example. Every moment that we can live that as our teacher.
So there seems to me that there's been some struggle with the word path, and whether or not it's, we learn these things linearly. And what has occurred to me is that perhaps we learn them intellectually linearly, but as we become aware of them, we experience them as interpenetrating and multidimensionally. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know then what the path looks like, because the path is no longer linear in a path. It's something, do you see what I'm saying? No, maybe not. but I think for me, that piece, you know, came together for me, that the word path is semantics, and it's a way to move into an understanding of the philosophy, psychology, experience, whatever. But once there, it's no longer linear.
Yeah. I think the path is our sincere commitment to practice.
Okay.
And you know, the Eightfold Path as well, that, you know, is usually taught linearly, but it's not the least bit linear. I mean, right. We have the wisdom factors in the beginning, and actually by the end of cultivating the Eightfold Path, the wisdom factors have gotten a lot stronger, and they're, you know, at the end. So
it's a swirl.
I think just to rejoice in having a path, mm-hmm. and to see what unfolds and be there for what unfolds with our deep sincerity.
Thank you.
That's the path.
Thank you.
So in line with what you're saying, said earlier, what's worked for me as regarding suffering is not to have a view toward it at all. Mm. Because when I start actually forming views is the way people usually try to deal with suffering. And I find if I don't form a view of it and just experience it directly without a view, that's the best way to let it burn out.
That's pretty good advice. I mean, there's a lot of what we have to do on this path is letting go of our fixed views and letting go of our opinions and, you know, wanting to be right. And we get into a lot of trouble with our views. So right view is an interesting practice as well. Thank you for that.
Sounds like beginner's mind.
It does. Yep. Okay, so let's take a moment to close. May our practice benefit all beings. May we and all beings trust our living awareness as our essence. May we and all beings radiate our inner peace. May we and all beings be free.